Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why can't we forget Gone with the Wind? Both the David O. Selznick film and the Margaret Mitchell novel it was based on have been decried by various critics for extraordinary racism, blatant sexism, and scandalous content. The book is not highbrow literature, and the movie, as critic Molly Haskell has written, would not be caught dead in a film class. And yet we can't quite get Scarlett and Rhett and Mammy and Melanie out of our heads. The characters are indelible, and the story too intriguing to fit neatly into the guilty pleasure category. So what works and what doesn't about Gone with the Wind, and how have its literary and visual images shaped American culture and American art? Writer and film critic Molly Haskell is my guest this hour. She explores those questions in her new book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. Molly, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you very much.
What makes Gone with the Wind important?
Well, just the fact that, as you suggested, it has such a hold on our imagination, we can't get rid of it. I mean, I'm not sure we really want to, but sometimes I think some people would like to. I think they've felt it's pernicious. I don't really believe. I think the messages are too mixed to be seen as entirely, you know, a noxious influence. But, I mean, just the score. You started with Max Steiner's score. It's hard to hear that without sort of choking up a little. When you've been through something, it's the intensity of it, the length of it, the anguish, the suffering, and also the highs of it. It just sort of touches on every emotion, and so many different people and so many different parts of the world have identified with it. It's almost like the I Ching. You can find your own message somewhere in it. So I think it just has an enormous amount of identification appeal.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you write about the various responses to it over time. They really say a lot about where we are as a society.
They do. I think one of the things that seems dated now is that the plantation myth. I think that had such a hold on the national imagination for quite a long time after the Civil War. But now that's faded, but other things come to the surface. I mean, what's really fascinating is that when the film opened in when the book came out in 1936, the movie in 1939, on the preview cards, everyone in the audience saw it as a Depression fable and responded to it that way. And now here we are again in another recession, depression, and very similar. I mean, it's preceded by a period of splurge and excess, and then a sudden awakening and shock. And I think it'll be interesting to see. I saw it with an audience recently, and the minute I introduced it, I mentioned depression. You could just feel the response in the audience at that. And that's an angle that people seem to have picked up on.
Just how big was the novel when it first came out?
It was huge. It was funny, too, because Macmillan had to, since it was so long, they had to up the usual price, and it was cost $3, and Margaret Mitchell was just shocked and amazed that people would pay $3 for a book in the middle of the Depression. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It was, as you say, decried by the highbrow critics and the left-wingers, but the public just ate it up, and it's continued to sell. It's never, you know, it's never gone out of print. You go to any Barnes & Noble, and there it is, you know, right up there.
It was written at a time, Molly, when both women and African Americans were in the process of sort of redefining their rights and their roles in society. We don't really see that transition, though, on the part of the enslaved characters in the book. It's really only women that are sort of testing their new roles.
It's only women that are what?
Testing their new roles.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, people talk about, I think one of the things, one of the liberating things now, it's, I think there was a period where it was just hard to watch in the 70s when the sense of racial injustice was so keen, and it was, we cringed at seeing these sort of racial stereotypes. And I think a more nuanced view has come to prevail, largely with, you know, the endorsement of black scholars or scholars of black cinema, that it's much more complex. But in fact, what is the group that is maligned, the group that has a class action suit, would be the males, and particularly the white males. I mean, it's a total matriarchy, and it's Scarlett and Mammy and Melanie in her way. And in the book, of course, there are more women that don't make it to the screen who are very powerful and interesting. And it's the men who are sort of moral failures or weak and who sort of fall by the wayside. And it's a very kind of social Darwinism, and it's the women who have the gumption, is one of Margaret Mitchell's favorite words.
Yeah,
and the redefining, yes, because in fact, even though it came out as a Depression fable, Margaret Mitchell was writing it out of her experience of the 20s. She was a rebel and a flapper in the 20s, and that was really her sense of herself. And also, it was her grandmother. She said once that, you know, she was a newspaper reporter for a while, and she gravitated towards these older women who'd survived the Civil War. So it was an older generation, her grandmother's generation, and she was fascinated by them. And they were the ones she thought had the gumption. And she said she actually felt more at home in their era than in hers. So they're kind of different strands of powerful women and a sort of quasi-feminism that run through it.
And in fact, arguably, really the strongest and noblest character in the book, and the only one who ever really calls Scarlett on her own behavior, is Mammy.
Exactly. I mean, Hattie McDaniel, of course, she got an Oscar. She was the first African-American ever to win an Oscar. The role became more central. I mean, it's, of course, central in the book, too, but it became larger with Hattie McDaniel because she started playing these sort of sassy maids in movies. So they sort of built that up, and she's not only the person that sort of talks back and tells it like it is. She's intuitive. She understands Scarlett better than anyone. She calls her bluff. Scarlett's everyone's scared of her, and she is absolutely the most powerful figure. In fact, if anything, she's an idealized version. I mean, there were black women who were very close to the house blacks and were close to their mistresses and had power, but I don't think anything quite like Hattie McDaniel's Mammy.
How did her receiving the Oscar sort of change the way everybody looked at the abilities of African-American actors beyond playing? I mean, in some ways, she's playing the classic stock character, and in other ways, it was really, several levels
it.
Above.
That's it. She transcends it. I mean, she'd already begun to transcend the stock character of the maid, and this was sort of the culmination of what she'd already brought to that. And I think that's what scholars like Donald Bogle say. Well, people say, well, the movie doesn't show black resistance. It doesn't show blacks going and joining the Union Army. No, but it does show blacks in roles that are way beyond what any blacks were doing at the time and who, because of their own force of personality and talent, transformed these roles into something rich and complex. And, of course, Hattie McDaniel's the prime example. I mean, at the time, there was a lot of resistance on the part of blacks to that because they just saw this. I think this is the trouble with people who read film too literally, and this is usually true of people who are looking at it purely through a political lens. That's all they can see. And this is very harmful because if you say, well, blacks can't play maids, then you're suddenly going to take a whole category of roles away from them, which they would have played because that's what they were doing in society at the time. So I think there was something a little short-sighted about some of this, but it did change the conversation. After that, Hollywood began to, sort of question its own treatment of blacks, and they did broaden the scope of blacks on the screen. And of course, we've seen, up until today, it's sort of a direct line from that to Obama, I think.
Remarkably, though, if you watched the movie, you could not and knew nothing else about the Civil War. You might not even understand that slavery was a major issue in the Civil War.
No, and you would think that Lincoln had started the war, of course. Well, it's interesting because if you compare it to something like Birth of a Nation, the great and troublesome D.W. Griffith epic of 1915, That reconciliation was a theme. It was the South and the North. There were good people in the North and good people in the South, and Lincoln was a hero. Here, Lincoln is the villain, and the South is the victim. And, you don't know that there's anything going on with... I mean, in fact, the only voice, the major voice you get, the black voice, is, of course, Mammy, and she's a snob, and she doesn't like these carpetbaggers who've come to give the blacks jobs and things like that. So, yeah, it's very that's a very narrow and bigoted view of particularly of Reconstruction.
And surprisingly, too, Mammy is the one who says the most racist things in the film. It's almost like the existence of that character
allows
shields the white
say,
characters from culpability.
Absolutely, and she uses the word nigger. Of course, the word nigger was in the script in other places, and Selznick took it out, which was a very wise thing to do. But he allowed it to stay in the mouth of Mammy, and yes, that's a true thing on Margaret Mitchell's part too, to have Mammy say these things that it would be completely racist and unacceptable if you had a white person saying them.
Margaret Mitchell is really a fascinating character,
isn't she?
A tomboy, some would say a bully, raised to be a Southern Belle.
Yeah, she was everything, and she was very divided. That's what's interesting. I mean, I think that in some peculiar way, her dividedness and also Selznick and Lee, who were all both all sort of a little bit crazy in similar or at least complementary ways. But she was just, her mother was an activist and a suffragette and very serious and high-minded. And Margaret reacted against it. Margaret wasn't an intellectual at all. Her mother really was an intellectual. She read, you know, the most important books of the day, and she fought for women's rights. And Margaret didn't get involved in any of that. And she read trash sort of almost deliberately to provoke her mother. And she embraced this whole sort of flapper values. And then she did it almost like an about-face. As soon as the book was written, she retreated into this little old, almost prematurely, matronly little lady persona. It was like she went from being Scarlett to being Melanie, and it sort of almost disavowed Scarlett. But there's a kind of detachment between her and Scarlett. You never know what to believe. She writes, of course, she's just a massive letter writer. That became her form of writing after the book, because she never wrote another book. But she's always being surprised that Scarlett was the heroine, that she didn't mean for that to happen. I mean, you have to sort of take everything she says with a grain of salt. But I think there's some truth in that. I think Scarlett sort of got away from her in a way.
Well, there were some interesting parallels between Margaret Mitchell's life and Scarlett's life in terms of her relationship, both of their relationships to their mothers, who were sort of busy helping everyone else and not
exactly
so much around the house, and then died young.
Yeah, very much so. And you know what's fascinating? It just struck me also is that the parallel with Katharine Hepburn, because they were both born around the same time, Katharine Hepburn a few years later. Both had these very powerful, very distinguished suffragette activist mothers who made them feel kind of small and inadequate. And both of them were, Margaret and Katharine, were big sort of show-offs in reaction against the serious-mindedness of the mothers, and very kind of narcissistic. And I think that was true. And yet she was in awe of her mother, and she was, and also this different, abandoned by her in the sense that her mother died when she was 18. So I think that this is the other very powerful emotion that fuels the book and the movie, this longing for a mother, the sense of abandonment, this fear of abandonment, and that just sort of throbs through it and gives it an undercurrent that it wouldn't otherwise have, I think.
And yet, although Katharine Hepburn very much wanted the role of Scarlett O'Hara, of course, it went to Vivien Leigh.
Yeah, well, every actress in Hollywood wanted it. And most of them, well, the prominent ones would not take screen tests. The ones who were sort of lower down on the totem pole would. But she was convinced that Cukor wanted her for it, but he didn't. He knew she was wrong for it as much as he adored her, and she was. But everyone thought they were Scarlett, and I think it was obviously the right thing to do to get an unknown, which Vivien Leigh was, and even an English one, I think, because for very many reasons, but one of which is that I can't imagine any actress, with the possible exception of Bette Davis, who wouldn't somehow have toned it down and made her more lovable or likable. I mean, Vivien Leigh never softens the character, never tries to ingratiate herself with the audience. I mean, imagine somebody like Norma Shearer doing it. In fact, her fans said, "You can't do this. She's too mean. You can't." They didn't want nice Norma Shearer to play this mean woman.
Molly Haskell is my guest. She's a writer and film critic. Her new book is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. We will talk more after the break. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-933-5372. We will talk when we come up about the differences between David Selznick's vision of Gone with the Wind and Margaret Mitchell's and how that all played out. Back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. if I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill. As God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
That, of course, is a clip from the iconic 1939 film Gone with the Wind. Molly Haskell is my guest this hour. She's a writer and film critic. Her new book is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Of course, as we know, Molly, those of us who are familiar with the book and the movie, Scarlett O'Hara does all of those things. Lies, steals, cheats, and kills. How is it that we... somehow, nobody likes her, but nobody hates her either.
Well, I think for a number of reasons. One is she also does these admirable things. Her courage is unbelievable. She's sort of forthright. She refuses to, I think particularly when I was growing up, there was something so delicious about how unladylike she was. She refused to conform to all the standards of ladylike behavior. And there was something refreshing, because this was right before the kind of groundswell of the women's movement. So that spoke to us. She really was sort of plain-spoken. She challenged the whole system of male supremacy. She had no truck with all that, with all of the South's myths about it themselves. I mean, there was something very practical and realistic about her and hard-headed. And then after the war, she became a shrewd businesswoman. I mean, one of the things I say is that if women today knew as much about mortgages as she did, there wouldn't be so many out on the street. I mean, she just learned and did. So there's something admirable about that. Another thing is that the characters, I think, in fact, Margaret Mitchell and, of course, the film play it both ways a little bit. They allow her to be very bad, and yet they have these wonderful people who love her. I mean, in real life, probably they would have gotten exasperated with her a long time before that. But you have Mammy, who sticks with her, and Melanie, who, beyond all reason, adores her. And Rhett Butler, and I mean, they all love her, and we love them. We trust them. They have a sort of moral authority that she doesn't. So this happens in movies, in other movies, too, where you have a woman character who's morally ambiguous, and yet other people love her. That allows us to love them, or at least forgive them, too. So I think all of these play into it. And Vivian Leigh is just so, I mean, dazzling. So there's something, I mean, it's sort of unfair in a way, but she just seduces us.
The one thing Vivian Leigh doesn't have going for her, or you can say does have going for her, is that when Margaret Mitchell describes the character for the first time, she lets us know that Scarlett O'Hara is not beautiful, but nobody figures that out until they're too enchanted by her to get away.
Right.
And Vivian Leigh is hardly someone who is...
No.
By any category, not striking.
No. I think that I agree completely, but I think that's a trope that you can do in literature where you have somebody where you don't actually see them. I mean, you have this in Victorian literature all the time, that you have a heroine who's not... conventionally beautiful. The stupid people don't think she's plain. You know, they don't think she's beautiful at all. But the wise people, the right man sees her beauty where no one else does. So that's really what she's talking about. Somebody who, a little bit like Becky Sharp. I mean, there's one parallel with Becky Sharp, who's not a knockout, but who has something more important than that. But in movies, you sort of can't quite do that. I think the beauty has to stand, the soul's, well, in any case, you have a certain amount of surface beauty. I mean, for instance, Betty Davis would fit more in, with that description, with the book's description, and yet somehow you can't imagine her in that role, or at least not in any way as incandescent and dazzling as Vivian Leigh is. I think she has to dazzle visually.
So let's talk about the movie for a minute. One of the first things that David O. Selznick had to do is figure out how to condense this extraordinarily long book into even a 3.5-hour movie.
Yeah, I know. That's a short version of the book, isn't it?
Yes. So how did he choose what to cut out?
Well, Sidney Howard is, I think, most responsible. So there were like 15 people. I mean, it never should. The movie shouldn't have worked. There were just too many cooks that should have spoiled the broth, and somehow that didn't happen. Sidney Howard, a well-known playwright and movie writer, really hammered it into shape, and then other people came in on it. Ben Hecht and Selznick himself was doing a lot of the writing, not very good apparently. That was one of the things that was slowing things up. But Sidney Howard said, well, Margaret Mitchell repeats everything twice. Well, she does, but there's also a lot they had to leave out, and there were things. Selznick was dying to have one battle scene, and they actually shot one, and they kept that out. So they were dropping things by the wayside, and I think they probably made fairly judicious decisions. I mean, there's some, if you read the novel, the things you miss, but they're not absolutely essential. And the thing about it is it just moves. This is what's so amazing, particularly the first half. Just it's astonishing how much, I mean, that scene when she goes to 12 Oaks and you have her trying to seduce Ashley and meeting Rhett Butler for the first time and the war starting and all that happens within about 5 minutes. You know, it's just amazing. So it it's propulsive.
One of the cuts that I think is really interesting is the fact that, and you find it a little easier not to hate Scarlett. In the book, she's got these two other children, Wade Hampton and Ella, who are born.
Oh, she's a horrible mother. That's the other, yeah.
Yeah, but
God.
We don't see that in the movie.
Thank goodness. That was a very wise decision, I think, because I think you really would come to despise her if you saw the way she treated those children. And there was something outrageous about it, because this is the one sacred thing in most literature that, if a bad mother automatically alienates the audience, and somehow Rita stayed with it. That's one of the more amazing things to me about the book. How that didn't seem to come, didn't seem to undermine it for readers. She really is just awful. She's just not a mother, and there's something, in a way, sort of wonderfully honest about it.
She's almost. I mean, in some ways, Scarlett operates like a man.
A man, she is. Well, I guess the war...
Not that men aren't wonderful parents, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, the other thing when we're talking about why we stay with her, I think the war. Once you have a crisis like that, all bets are off a little, or at least it relaxes standards, and she becomes very masculinized because she has to. So this is the thing. I mean, we feel this is not... I mean, she's not greedy in the way that a lot of people are greedy or have been greedy on Wall Street or something. Just, I mean, she is. She's very materialistic, but... At this point, it's not greed. She wants to save her homestead and the people on it. So she's doing something for something beyond herself, and she's just doing it with every ounce of energy she has. So I mean, there has to be something awesome and admirable about that, I think, and excused. It really is somehow justified.
Molly Haskell is my guest. Her new book is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. We should mention here, as a point of trivia, since we mentioned Wade Hampton, that you are actually a descendant of the real General Wade Hampton, after whom Scarlett's first child was
named. That's right. That's right. And the father was the ignominious Charles, who died. He went off to war and promptly died, not of a war wound, but of measles. So, yes, I am.
The first in a long line, I guess, of people she marries for expediency's sake.
Yes, and takes away from other people. She steals a man from India Wilkes, the first one, and then from her sister, her sister's fiancé. So, I mean, that to me is somehow the worst. And she's no friend to other women, that's for sure. I mean, that's one feminist theme she certainly doesn't exhibit, is solidarity with other women. It's all for herself, and other women are the enemy. You know, this but this too is sort of honest about the conditioning of young women at the time was towards marriage, and marriage, getting as many beaux as possible, so to make the appropriate selection. So there was a natural rivalry there.
How scandalized were people at the time that the book and then the movie came out about this idea that Rhett Butler ultimately rapes Scarlett when she's his wife?
You know, I don't know what they thought at the time. Nobody in the reviews I've looked at, nobody mentions. I think it was in the 70s, again, where we were sort of primed. I mean, that was a big theme of the women's movement, was rape and especially wife battery. So in the 70s, it was people just couldn't even watch it. I always felt that it was not, that rape is the wrong word. Maybe it's an idealized version of something that actually did happen to Margaret Mitchell, where this first husband, this rogue bootlegger first husband she had, did attack her. She took him to court. So, I mean, then the husband had none of the charm of Rhett. So I think you have to look at it, this in a context of a kind of fantasized version, and also of somebody, I mean, there's tremendous love, and you have to look at it in the consequences of it. I mean, what is her reaction? We see the next morning she's finally deliriously aroused and satisfied for the first time, probably in the first and last time in her life. So I think it has to be seen in that context.
Few works of literature have generated so many responses, sequels, parodies written by other people. Mary in Dallas asks, we'll start with this one, if you would comment on the sequel written much later titled Scarlett.
Yeah. Well, it was amazingly a bestseller. It was, I can't even, Alexandra Ripley had been chosen because she was Southern and a writer, and for whatever reason, she never liked Scarlett, which is an odd thing for someone to take on, I think. And she has her going to Ireland, and I mean, to me, there is no sequel that ends when it ends. But people have always wanted them to get back together in the end. So this is a sort of response to that urge, I think. And it was a bestseller. It's not very good. She's not a very interesting character in it. She has a child with Red, and she's going to become a good mother. And all these kind of softening effect. That's precisely what Margaret Mitchell avoided. And then there's the other one that was more recent called Craig's, Rhett Butler's People. The author's name is Craig, which is like a prequel. It shows who Rhett was before, and also sort of more politically correct, because Rhett as a child plays with the little black boys, and he's sort of anti-aristocratic in certain ways. And so I think what you said earlier, we see it in terms of our own, the zeitgeist of the time. So people have sort of adapted it to what they see as the yearnings of contemporary audiences.
And then you have critical things written that were supposed to sort of parallel the book. The Wind Done Gone comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It's a sort of it was questionable. I guess it was legally decided to be a parody so that there was no, the Mitchell Estate couldn't stop the publication of it. So interesting, and there have been other black versions like that give the black women the power in it, and I think that's a, sort of a more interesting twist on it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Frank in Fort Worth writes, I have a dear friend born and raised in Atlanta and is a Gone with the Wind diehard. He's traveled all over the world and has never visited a country that he could not find the book printed in that language.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. That really is interesting. Yeah, I think it's. I love listening to it and finding out about how other countries have responded to it.
How different was the response in this country based on whether you lived in the North or in the South?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, the South adored it. It was, and it became like holy scripture. And in fact, and I tell the story of this friend of mine, a middle-aged man from Kentucky, who gave his mother Rhett Butler's People. I read it to her. She's sort of bedridden, and she was thrilled to learn about where Rhett had come from. And nobody could convince her that they weren't real people. I mean, to the Southerners, they are real. They're more real than their own family. And it's sort of hard to argue. It's one of the things where you feel a little trepidation in taking on writing about something like this. It's just sacred to them. It never had that quite that intense an appeal in the North, but all my Northern friends loved it. They fell in love with it just like I did when they were 13 or 12 or 13 years old. And I guess it was a slightly different appeal. It was the exoticism of the Southern myth, the Southern plantation life, whereas for Southerners it was something fairly recent and more real, more of our history in a sense.
Let's talk about Clark Gable as Rhett Butler. He wasn't a fan of Selznick or his work.
No, he didn't want to do it. He thought, and you can understand why, it was out of his comfort zone. he played sort of love him and leave him. He played rogues, but never rogues that had that kind of intensity and also that had to be passive. I mean, it was really her story. And he didn't want to do it in the worst way, but he had no power. The studios owned him, and MGM decided he was going to do it. He was going to do it. He didn't like Selznick, but I think he had to do it, number one. And he was married to Carol Lombard at the time, and she pushed him to do it. She wanted him to stretch himself and do something more ambitious. So, and the main thing is, of course, he knew people had this image of Rhett, and he was afraid of that, afraid of letting them down. And that was... It was a huge risk for him.
And he didn't really do much with the accent, nor did Vivian Leigh, we should say. They didn't really ever sound like Southerners.
Well, hers is better, and hers is pretty good, I think. It didn't bother me the way sometimes. I think the English is sort of closer to it anyway. Very often the English actors do Southern accents better than other Americans do it. So hers is there. I mean, but he just discarded it altogether, and I think that was one of the smartest things, or it may not have been even so much a decision, as he just couldn't do it, because that way he just seems more himself. I mean, he is iconic. There's something not completely Southern about him. He's more cosmopolitan. I mean, this is somebody who has a sense of the whole world, which nobody else there does. So it sort of fits, I think, for him not to have a Southern accent.
What did playing the character of Ashley Wilkes do for Leslie Howard's career?
Well, it's a strange career. It didn't, I think some people, I remember people loved him in sort of earlier generations. I think he was old by this time, although he looks better in the same year he's in an intermezzo with Ingrid Bergman, and he looks better. That's in black and white. I think he just was wooden in here, but that was kind of what the character was anyway. The character was weak and miserable and melancholy, and Howard was weak, was miserable too. So it sort of fit. He didn't want to do it, and Selznick got him to do it by telling him he could direct. He really wasn't that interested in his film career, I don't think, and you feel that a little bit.
Are we meant, do you think, not to ever understand what it is that Scarlett sees in Ashley?
Well, I don't think so, because I think people do. I loved it. I mean, there were arguments over Brett versus Ashley, and when I was growing up, now nobody gets it. But then he had this huge appeal. It was this sort of diffident, hard to get, poetic man, and especially my mother's generation, the Englishness of him was very attractive, and he was cultured and he seemed cultured and cultivated, and just unavailable. That's something about that unavailability that women went for. And now it's just almost hard to explain, because nobody gets that anymore. That's one of the things, I guess, that's dated the most. But he was hot in his cool way, you know.
Molly Haskell is my guest. We're talking about her new book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Brett, please don't say that. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for everything.
My darling, you're such a child. You think that by saying I'm sorry, all the past can be corrected. Here, take my handkerchief. Never in any crisis of your life have I known you to have a handkerchief.
Red, where are you going?
I'm going to Charleston, back where I belong.
Please take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want peace. I want to see if somewhere there isn't something left in life of charm and grace. You know what I'm talking about?
No. I only know that I love you.
That's your misfortune. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
The penultimate sentence ever uttered in the movie Gone with the Wind there. Molly Haskell is my guest this hour. Her new book is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. Everybody forgets that Scarlett has some lines after that.
That's right. That seems like it's such a wonderful end. And yet, at the same time, I think it would be a little too crushing almost. And it was Selznick who decided to have a little bit more of an uplift at the end by having all these ghostly voices come and pull her back to Tara, so to give her some sort of uplift.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bill in Arlington. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi there. Interesting program. I'll have to find your guest book and take a read out of it. I've read Gone with the Wind, I think, 3 times in my life. It's just the first time I read it, I was in college, and I had started a few pages here and there casually, and getting ready to study for finals one night, I said, well, I'll read a few more pages, and I finished about 95% of the book throughout the night.
You failed your exams?
at 7 o'clock in the morning, I finished the last page, and I threw the book down in disgust.
You did? Disgust at yourself or at the book?
At the book. At the time, I didn't fully understand her, and I said, what a stupid woman. And I threw the book down on the floor, woke up my roommate, and...
Well, you did read the whole thing, though. Why didn't you stop earlier? So there's something was keeping you going.
It certainly was. and as you mentioned about the sequel, it just didn't seem to work, the sequel.
No, but it's interesting because men like this as well. I mean, the people who want to dismiss it always talk about a women's picture this, women's picture that, and, of course, a woman is at the center. But a lot of men love it, both the book and the movie. It's a real crossover that way, I think.
Well, I think it is. It's a powerful ending in the story and in the movie as well.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, I just wanted to relate that. And,
that's really interesting. I like hearing that. I love hearing people how different people have encountered it and what impact it had on them. So that is interesting. So you read it two more times after that, then you couldn't have been too disgusted.
I guess you came back to it, Bill, to give it a second and a third try?
I did. I've read it three times. And the first time I read it, I was just a young teenager. And so perhaps... at 7 o'clock in the morning after an all-nighter of reading it.
It changes your perspective.
Yeah. It did. Yeah. But it was a good read, and I hope your program inspires people who haven't read Gone with the Wind to go find it.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, and Molly, you actually say that it doesn't necessarily, as a literary document, it doesn't really reward multiple readings.
Well, I don't know. That's my feeling about it, just because... although I must say, when I read it again to write about it, there were things that surprised me that I hadn't remembered. But then I hadn't read it. I don't think I really ever read it more than once when I was growing up. The richness of some of the women characters and some of the black characters that didn't make it into it. I think it's almost irrelevant to discuss high literature, middle-brow literature, whatever. I think it's just it's a fantastically well-told tale. She's not a great prose stylist, and she does repeat herself. I mean, and also, there is something that limitedness of Scarlett does wear on you finally a bit, I think, because she's like an adolescent that never grows up, and there is you can't help but feel some sense of exasperation. But also, she to me reminds me of everyone's adolescent self, and maybe that's part of the irritation in a way that we can't. There's something painful about seeing ourselves in that sort of selfish mode where we're just so self-centered and ungenerous as she was.
We have an email from Jay who says, I'd like to hear your comments about Melanie. How are we supposed to view her? I've always thought that she was a model of kindness and patience. Friends disagree, saying she's as strong as a wet noodle. What's the real
take? That's a great question. In fact, I did a piece for Town and Country recently in which I said, let's take another look at Lady Melanie. Because that was the feeling when I grew up, that she was the goody-goody and Scarlett was the one that was exciting and temperamental and radical. And Scarlett was more the sort of model of what you might call the women's liberation. And Melanie was the one who behaved properly and we were impatient with. But now I think Scarlett's legacy, you see it in people like Madonna or sort of the shopaholics and the Sex and the City and the greed and all of that. And there's a legacy there that Scarlett has bequeathed that is sort of obnoxious. And I think maybe we tossed the word lady out prematurely, and maybe it's time to bring the word lady back, because lady, the whole idea of ladylike behavior kind of went out of fashion. And I think now you can look at Melanie, and she's interesting in it. I think Olivia de Havilland really gives an interesting performance, and she's the one that really has the happier life. She marries the man she loves, and she is interested in the community. She does things for other people, and she has a very happy, satisfying life, which Scarlett never does.
You have a quote, actually, on the back of the book from Olivia de Havilland. I'm ashamed to say I didn't know that she was even still with us.
Well, most people didn't. She's 92, living in Paris, as you can tell from the quote, with all of her wits about her.
Uh-huh. Did you have a chance to meet her personally?
I haven't. I hope very much to. I've just communicated with her by letter. But I hope I'll get to Paris one of these days and meet her.
How did she feel about the character she was playing?
She loved it. She wouldn't have wanted to play Scarlett. And she campaigned for it because she was at Warner Brothers, and they didn't want to lend her out. Selznick wanted her for the role. And she went out to lunch with Jack Warner's wife, with whom she was friendly, and said, look, not only would this be a great role for me, but it would be great for Warner Brothers. It would be a feather in their cap. And she convinced Anne, and Anne went home and convinced her husband, and that's how she got to play Melanie.
And in some ways it was we don't talk about so much this element in movies back then, but it was a courageous performance in that it was a very beautiful woman, but certainly didn't fear
she
looking
made herself plain.
Yeah.
She really did. I mean, she's still beautiful, but not in the way that she actually was in other movies, and she wanted to do it that way. She was given the choice, she says. She's a wonderful interview. There's a disc in the four-disc set of Gone with the Wind, and she gives an interview in which she said, Cukor said, now you can play this beautiful, you can play it plain, and she said, I want to play it plain. And they adopted the sort of part-in-the-middle hairstyle of Melanie and the sort of sickly look and all of that. I mean, she was sort of, she really made herself into a little bit of a brown wren.
Let's go next to Lanisa in Dallas. Hi, Lanisa.
Hi, Chris. I love your program every day. I don't miss you. Thank you for talking about Gone with the Wind. That was the first book I ever read on my own, and I loved it so that I would be under the covers when my parents told me to go to sleep with a flashlight. I adored Scarlett O'Hara, and even as a black woman, I always thought myself as Scarlett. Thank you for talking about this. That book, I had forgotten it.
Lindy, so were you conflicted about liking the book as a black woman?
I was not. I never saw myself. I always saw myself as the heroine, and I thought Scarlett was the heroine. And maybe it was because of the times that were changing. Because, you know, at that time we were starting integration, and I had been raised on an army base that was always integrated. So I never saw Scarlett in a color. I love her.
That's fantastic, because there are other black women who've said the same thing. I think they were afraid to say it for a while, but there was an interview on NPR in which some young black women, or maybe they're in their 30s or 40s now, had exactly the same experience, where they discovered it when they were young, and they completely adored and identified with Scarlett. I mean, because she's a back-talking person, you know, that's what she is. It's just the way I think women often, or girls, identify with male roles when they're growing up. You know, we're tomboys, and where the action is, that's where we want to be. So I think that's very interesting. And also, the experience is almost universal of that under the bedclothes with the flashlight. You know, there was something forbidden about it. So that was Margaret Mitchell actually said that her mother, if her mother had been alive, her mother wouldn't have allowed her to read Gone with the Wind until she was 18.
How did she feel about the finished film?
Well, she was, I think, hugely relieved. I think she was terrified that it was going to be an embarrassment. I mean, she trusted Selznick more than anybody, but at the same time, she just did not want to be embarrassed in front of her friends. That was the only thing she cared about. So she had this, Susan Myrick was a friend of hers who was on the set sort of vetting the Southern accents and decorum and whatnot. And so she would get regular reports from Susan to know how things were going. And she really did like it. I think she thought the casting was great. She was in Selznick. She was very gracious in thanking Selznick. I think she was very pleased. And if she had any objections, she pretty much kept them to herself, or at least she wrote them in letters that were then destroyed. So we don't know if she had misgivings. But I think she was very pleased with it.
She was only, what, in her 30s when the book was published, right?
That's right. She was born in 1900, so 36 was published. She was 36 years old.
Why didn't she ever write anything else?
Well, I think nothing prepared her for what came, what happened. I mean, this blockbuster, who could have expected anything like that? It was so huge, and her life was completely turned upside down, and then even more so when the film came around, because everybody was kind of knocking at all these women were knocking at her door. They wanted to play Scarlett. They wanted her autograph. They wanted to do this and that. Her life was just sort of a hell. And she found ways of sort of protecting herself from that, but she hadn't, she spent 9 years on this book. She just couldn't do it. She didn't want to do it again. She had no desire to do it again. And then she wrote letters to everybody, I mean, like good old Southern thank you notes, but at great lengths to everyone, to the reviewers, anyone who wrote her, she wrote back. So that was her book.
And how engaged was she in the ongoing sort of reputation and marketing of the book and the film?
Well, her big, her obsessive concern was copyright. Her brother and father were copyright lawyers, so she was just zealous in looking out for copyright infringement, and that kept her going for a long time. She was always finding foreign publishers who had somehow published it without having the rights to it. I think she didn't get involved. She refused to sign autographs. She hated giving speech. Unlike her mother, she could not speak in public. So she really withdrew from public life pretty much. She would go to things like Atlanta Women Journalist lunches and things like that. But she didn't, and I think she sort of hated the exposure, and she was worried about what people would write about her, so she was busy protecting her privacy. I think that was really what she did.
We haven't spoken yet, and we have to, about the amazing performance by Butterfly McQueen.
Oh, yeah.
As Prissy.
Well, that was one of the more vexed, much more than Hattie McDaniel, because she seemed to be this sort of simpering coward, but she's just so hilarious. I think if there'd been a cultural czar on the set, or there were people wanted to have a black person on the set to censor or say what they could and couldn't do, probably would have eliminated her, and that would have been a huge loss, I think, because Butterfly McQueen is fantastic. I mean, for one thing, it's a kind of parallel to Scarlett. She's a sort of mirror image of Scarlett in her. She's got her mother, who doesn't make it into the film, is a beautiful half Indian black woman, sort of aristocratic like Scarlett's mother, and both these sort of ideal women, and the daughters are poor, pathetic imitations of. I mean, they just can't hack it in any way like their mothers, and they're both sort of scallywags and renegades. And one of the points that a black scholar made is that also Butterfly McQueen expresses the fear and the horror that the audience feels. I mean, Scarlett's so busy being brave, but Butterfly McQueen is just shrill in the expression of horror. And there's something very, I think, sly and wonderful about her performance. I think she contributes a huge amount to the film.
One of the things you write that I just love, as we conclude here, is that the critics and the fans of both the movie and the book are both right.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's all there, the good and the bad, and yeah. I think so.
Well stated. Yeah. Molly Haskell is a writer and a film critic. Her new book is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. Molly, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour.
Thank you, Chris. I've really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.